Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. It wasn't that long ago where we were looking at great new polls for Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. What had been a very tight race against likely Democratic nominee Mary Burke was about a 15-16-point edge for Walker. He was well over 50. That's always good news for an incumbent. His favorables are looking pretty good. Now we get even better news thanks to the Wall Street Journal. Turns out Ms. Burke, who is a union stalwart, has pretty much read the tea leaves in Wisconsin and decided her campaign is not going to be about fighting Scott Walker over the huge union debates from 2011. Here's what the Journal has to say. Burke sticks to a bread-and-butter argument that job growth has faltered under Mr. Walker. She talks up her business credentials as a former executive at her family's business. As Democrats see it, there is no realistic path to victory over Mr. Walker in November by building a campaign around restoring Wisconsin's public employee unions to their former status. She says she's not even going to fight to lift requirements that force public employees to contribute more to their health and pension benefits. She will try to roll back the collective bargaining changes that were made. Jim, what a difference 3 years makes.
By the way, just worth noting for the perspective on the outlook for Walker, there was a poll that came out that had him tied with Burke. A lot of people kind of raised their eyebrows at that, in that most polling had put him up ahead, as you said. Look, in the end, it's still Wisconsin. So the ceiling for a Republican in Wisconsin is probably about 51-52%. Walker's the favorite, but there's no expectation he's going to have a blowout in this. Now, if Mary Burke really doesn't want to push back on all the, you know, the hard-fought reforms, one, if you're a Wisconsin union and your standard bearer says, yeah, we're not going to fight on that, that's got to be kind of dispiriting. I mean, that basically there's, you know, what Scott Walker has done is now created a bipartisan policy consensus for the health and pension benefits. And worth noting here is that we have noticed a pattern in life in which a Democrat runs as a centrist and says, oh, I'm not going to do all this stuff, then gets into office and then turns around and does all the stuff they swore they weren't going to do. So if you're an undecided voter in Wisconsin and you like this law, the safe way to make sure that law stays in place is to reelect Scott Walker. With Mary Burke, there's always a slim chance. But again, it's also very intriguing that she's not campaigning on this, indicating that this is fairly publicly popular and not an area where she can really, you know, spur people to turn against Scott Walker on this. So really, in a way, winning the policy victory is as significant as winning the on election day, I would say.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in that fight would agree, and we'll see how intense the fight is in Michigan. That right-to-work debate made Rick Snyder's reelection a lot more fierce than it probably would have otherwise, but he's still ahead in the polls that we see so far, so keep an eye on that race as well. All right, on to the bad martini now, and there's nothing ever really good about the Syrian civil war, so it's pretty much guaranteed to be in the bad martini. As you know, we have the red line because Syria was using chemical weapons. They used them. We decided that we wanted to attack them. Then we didn't because Russia decided to call John Kerry on his bluff and say, sure, let's have the Syrians turn over their weapons of mass destruction and then we can avoid any military action. The Obama administration went along with that. According to the folks who are collecting all of these chemical weapons, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the Syrians have allegedly handed over the vast majority of their weapons, but they're harding on to about 27 tons of sarin gas ingredients because there's a dispute over what to do with the facilities and network of tunnels that were used to store these things. The group wants them destroyed. The Assad regime wants them to be repurposed for other things. And then the Washington Post goes on to say that even if they give up all their sarin ingredients, they still have chlorine, which apparently the international community is powerless to do anything about. So, Jim, all that, and we're pretty much back where we started.
You wish you had more you could say than just kind of roll your eyes and say, well, here we go again. Who's kind of surprised that Assad's not keeping his word? There doesn't really seem to be much of it. Remember, you know, that we had a carrier in the region, and that was vital to bringing him to the negotiating table, and that was forcing him to make concessions and all that stuff. And now, all of a sudden, it doesn't seem so clear. Chlorine, as we all know, is something you can use for legitimate, you know, non-hurting people purposes. So it's very tough to, you know, make some sort of effective ban on it. It is not as not quite as deadly or harmful, but anybody who's ever gotten a whiff of it or accidentally inhaled it knows it's not good. And if you use it as an anti-personnel, basically you just kind of, you know, spray it in there, people start coughing and choking and, you know, try to get out of there. We also remember in World War I, sure, troops being killed with chlorine gas. So, you know, You know, there's still a couple of folks who dispute that Assad was the one who used the sarin back then. But look, once the guy's shown that he's willing to gas people, really, you know, he's, well, it's only chlorine. You know, at that point, the level of harmfulness of the gas doesn't really matter. You know, now it's one of those things where if he feels really, you know, pressed by the rebellion, the uprising against him, he'll use the chlorine. Whether or not it's bad enough to kill people, you know, you can use it to flush people out and all that kind of stuff. Now, you know, everybody can rest assured the UN is saying it may investigate it. So, you know, I guess that'll take care of everything here. I also, you know, think as we look around the world, we're discussing this on Greta last night. You look at the situation with Russia and Ukraine and Putin, and you look at the recent you know, Asia trip that he took and the nervousness of our allies in South Korea and Japan. The red line really resonated, that all of a sudden the president said, you're not, you know, if this happens, there's going to be consequences. And then there weren't any really serious consequences. And that people now kind of realize, oh, America's off duty, and everybody's feeling some nervousness about how much, you know, what they can count on in this new isolationist moment. And I think the administration's attitude is just, you know, duck and cover and hope it stays out of the front page and remains to be an A3 story instead of a, you know, revelation that, oh, we've got a, you know, chemical weapon using, you know, maniac out of the Middle East and nobody really seems to want to do anything about it.
And on the other side, you've got folks that even Al-Qaeda says are going too far. So good times,
Syria. There's a crucifixion out in Syria, I understand. So, you know, old habits die hard in the Middle East, I suppose.
Apparently so. All right. On to the crazy martini now. And I lead in with a short story, Jim. I have a very good friend who lives in the Northern Virginia area, one of the greatest people I know. And the one thing we disagree on most intensely usually is politics. He's a strong supporter of President Obama. But he lives in the congressional district currently represented by Rob Whitman. I remember back in 2010, which is obviously a good year for Republican, did you vote for Whitman or the Democrat? And he says, I can't vote for somebody named Crystal Ball. So he didn't vote for the Democrat in that race. Crystal Ball, since then, has found herself in a lucrative position as a panelist on MSNBC. She's a regular on The Cycle, and I think they use her on other shows as well. This was her rant in response to conservative criticism over the book Capital by Thomas Piketty, where he says, we had this great progressive tax code that had the highest rate up in the 90s in World War II. So he says, we've always had in efforts to tamp down the rich. Here's Crystal Ball talking about where the great progressive income tax went wrong, and then her rant on Animal Farm.
It was only in the Reagan era that these rates were brought crashing down under the bizarre and ultimately incorrect belief that doing so would increase growth. For his trouble, Piketty has predictably gotten the full Cold War treatment. The National Review calls his book soft Marxism, and Lord only knows what they're saying over at less responsible outlets or in the comments section. Even the august and ostensibly economically literate Wall Street Journal tells him to read Animal Farm. Animal Farm, isn't that Orwell's political parable of farm animals where a bunch of pigs hog up all the economic resources, tell the other animals they need all the food because they're the makers, and then scare up the prospect of a phony boogeyman every time their greed is challenged? Sounds familiar.
Jim, MSNBC is giving airtime to someone who doesn't know the difference between communism and capitalism.
Somewhere there's some literary professor who had Crystal Ball as a student who is hanging his head in shame right now. Did you read Animal Farm or did you read the cliff? Like, have you read it? Or is this one of the, you've heard people talking about it and you know it's about animals and you know it's something about economics and, you know, that basically they have a plan and things don't turn out. For those who haven't read it, like, the whole point of it is that they're rebelling against the farmer, right? Like, they feel like they've been oppressed. And so they stage this revolution and the animals are in charge. And that as they have power, all of a sudden, the folks in power suddenly start not really honoring all those principles of the revolution. And something about all this terrible inequality, they begin to say, well, you know, we're in charge and we need a little extra food. We need, you know, look, because we're in charge, we are in our judgment, we deserve more stuff and you deserve less. It used to be, you know, that they were four-legged animals and they resented the two-legged animals of people. Then all of a sudden they start walking up on their hind legs and all of a sudden they start turning into exactly what they had been, you know, rebelling against, oppressing against. It's not about how bad it is to be greedy. It is about how efforts to be fair very often turn into just new forms of being unfair. That it's all about, you know, how revolutions tend to turn into that which they were rebelling against in the first place. And it's, you know, he's vehemently anti-communist and he's very vehemently anti-socialist. And, you know, this is all about how the people who are pledging to save you will one day turn into your new oppressors because once you give them the power. And It starts as, you know, two legs bad, four legs good. It turns into, you know, four legs good, but two legs better. Everyone is equal, but some people are more equal than others.
Yes.
That phrase comes from Animal Farm. This, you know, all this kind of stuff is in there. So first of all, I don't know if Crystal Ball knows this. That's the first problem there. Then I got to give credit to Ala Pundit. It takes some brass balls to try to pull Orwell on Orwell. To try to redefine the language to mean what you want it to mean instead of what it actually means. And this is still very active today. I spent way too much time this morning arguing with some ninny, because it's May Day, or as we call it in the free world, Thursday. Traditionally, this was the international socialist holiday for all the socialists back in the old Soviet Union and stuff like that. And so the guy's talking about how great, you know, socialism is. And I say, well, you know, there was the National Socialists, and then there was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and today there's North Korea, and there's Cuba, and there's, you know, I'd say China before they embrace the free market. I think you can argue that they're not really socialist now. Now they're just, you know, but the guy's like, no, that doesn't count. It totally doesn't count. No. In his mind, none of these countries are socialist. He's insisting North Korea is not a socialist country, even though I point to the Constitution, which explicitly says we are a socialist nation in accordance with socialist principles. Now, and, you know, when he's like, well, that's wrong. To socialist, socialism only occurs at the beginning part of the revolution. As soon as the, you know, people in charge start acting like the power-hungry people they were once denouncing, then it's not socialist anymore. And the argument of Orwell and the argument of all kinds of us on the right who've always seen trouble with this, standing athwart history, yelling stop, pointing out that every revolution in the name of the people always turns around and starts oppressing the people because it's just human nature. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's why you're supposed to spread this stuff around. That's why you need checks and balances. That's why you need new leaders in and out every couple of years. Anyway, that's my rant. As you can tell, this, you know, strikes a deep, deep chord in me. I'm just going to be in a cranky mood all day long because it's May Day, and I just can't wait. And, you know, the good news is Mother's Day is coming up soon, because I got to tell you, way too much today, Greg, I find myself calling other people mothers.
Yeah, we didn't even get to the part where she claimed that there was no growth under the Reagan tax cuts. And I think the most difficult part for you and your colleagues at National Review is she kind of gave you a backhanded compliment as being responsible.
Yeah, we're the reasonable ones. Yeah, like, don't do that.
Watch out for the rhino comments after that, man.
We are not a stick to be used to hit other conservatives with.
Right. Jim, on that note, enjoy your Thursday while others enjoy their May Day. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.